morning, everyone. We welcome you to this first panel of the conference called ETF Strategies in Today's Volatile Market. We have put together a select panel of experienced institutional users, and I think this is going to give us a great overview of what has happened to ETF institutional usage over the years. You might not see it from their faces, but they have been in the industry for some time to be able to know the before using ETFs in their firm and after using ETFs in their firm. So I think they really bring to our conversation a very great angle to what are the institutional challenges as well that you would face in larger institutions, for example, to include a new product such as an ETF in their mix. So keep in mind a lot of questions for them. Hopefully we're going to get to those at the end of our discussion. I was really excited about moderating this panel because institutional usage has been an area of my research. My name is, as Nicolas said, Sebastian Mercado, and I run ETF strategy for Deutsche Bank on the sell side of the institution, on the broker side. And one of my focus usually is to talk to institutional clients on how they're using ETFs nowadays. And ETFs, in my estimates, it's about 58% of the ownership goes to institutional players, as opposed to what most people think, that ETFs are mostly a retail product. So having this panel here together with a mix of representatives from the pension world, from the insurance company world, from the asset manager world, it's going to give us a great flavor of what's really happening with institutions. Without further ado, I would like to start introducing our panelists. We have here, starting on my left, Kevin McGrath, who is a high-yield trader and portfolio manager at the New Jersey Division of Investments Pension Fund. Next to him, we have Paul Pietronico, Director and Senior Portfolio Manager at Allianz Global Investors. Next to him, we have Doug Sandler, who is the Chief U.S. Equity Officer for River Front Investment Group. And last but not least, we have Jay Yoon, who is the CIO for New York Life Investment Management. So with that, I'll let each of our panelists maybe to tell us a little bit more about their role and their company so we can get more understanding of what they do. Kevin.
Sure. Kevin McGrath, the State of New Jersey Pension Fund is a 70-plus billion odd state pension. My role at the fund is with public high yield, which, you know, we have about a 2.5% target allocation, which puts you in an AUM of 1.5 to 2 billion, depending if we're overweight or underweight. We run the program. We outsource a part of it to asset managers, and we try to have a diversified, balanced overall portfolio. We have a defensive manager, a beta manager, a global manager. And then we also have an internal portfolio where the aim is to be tactical. So if we want to be overweight the asset class, we will do that internally, either with cash bonds. And this is where we use ETFs, is to be tactical as sort of a liquidity sleeve to add diversified exposure quickly.
Kevin.
I'm Paul Pietronico. I'm a senior portfolio manager at Allianz Global Investors and a member of the global multi-asset team. Allianz Global Investors is a global investment firm, total AUM 500 billion, offices around the globe, US, Europe, and Asia. The global multi-asset team, we have about 100 investment professionals, including 31 PhDs spread across 8 locations. The multi-asset team manages 124 billion total globally, with 80 billion of that in what we call dynamic asset allocation strategies. And our dynamic asset allocation process provides sort of a unique combination of risk mitigation in periods of market stress while providing potential for upside return enhancement when markets trend favorably. And we offer this approach across a range of vehicles for institutions. It's separate accounts, private commingled vehicles, model delivery, sub-advised, and actually overlay. For retail, it's mutual funds and CITs. And we're in the process of building out our liquid alternatives business around the globe and focused in New York City. I've been in the industry for 22 years. I've been managing multi-asset portfolios for the last 10. I'm the lead portfolio manager for our multi-asset income fund and our dynamic target date strategies, which are in mutual fund and CIT form. and also PM on our Global Dynamic Allocation and Fund and Multi-Asset Opportunities LLC, which is a sort of an absolute return take on multi-asset. Given our scale and range of vehicles, ETFs play a pretty important role in our investment process.
Yeah, Doug Sandler, Riverfront Investment Group. We're based in Richmond. I'm the small guy on the panel. We run about $6 billion. We do that all through retail advisors, so we don't do any direct-to-client. We really don't do a lot of institutional business either. You know, while we're small, I think our firm packs a lot of punch. We are rated the second or the ETF strategist of the year for 2 years in a row. We're also the second largest ETF manager in our space, according to Morningstar. And we run global asset allocation portfolios and been doing that since 2003. And if you think about it, that's about as far back as you can go in the ETF world, because fixed income ETFs didn't really start coming out until after that. So you had treasury ETFs, but that's about it. So we've been doing it for a long time. Thanks.
Thank you. My name is Jay Yoon. I'm a chief investment officer of New York Life Investment Management, called NILIM. We're about $290 billion of third-party client assets, and we're a wholly owned holding company of New York Life, the insurance company, and we're about 520 at the company level. And I'm the CIO of the holding company that owns a multi-boutique structure. We have nine boutiques, exactly, not about. And within that, we cover asset classes that expand broadly in public assets of all asset classes, as well as private and alternatives. And we're a global firm, so we're a global asset manager. And my role as chief investment officer of a holding company is to conduct oversight of investment process and results of our various boutiques, as well as I directly manage about $10 billion of asset allocation funds, long-only and liquid alt. And within that framework, we used to be mostly institutional and retail mutual funds. And obviously, in the last few years, we've expanded our capabilities to not only do liquid alts, but also have ETF products within our platform. And most recently, we've actually, in the last 2 years, purchased a ETF provider called IndexIQ, and somehow now we're dabbling in actually idea generation and research framework that goes into creation of ETFs. So what I thought was very interesting in terms of how we added value to IndexIQ was, as a purchaser of ETF, we were able to help design what would we want to own that would help diversify and complete our own portfolios. And perhaps I can get into that a little bit more later.
Thanks, gentlemen. Yes, so with those introductions, let's jump into the first area we want to discuss in the panel, which is the product usage or the ETF usage in your portfolios. So what role do ETFs play in your portfolio, and how do ETFs help you achieve your investment goals?
Sure. So we utilize, I kind of touched on this in my first answer, but we utilize ETFs as a liquidity sleeve where if we want exposure to a specific asset class quickly, particularly in the high yield space, that would be difficult to do with our staffing using cash bonds or other vehicles. We can't use derivative vehicles for legal reasons. So ETFs are a fantastic way. One trade, completely diversified to the index, immediate exposure. And then from there, if we want to tweak the portfolio, we could sell off the ETF as we buy cash bonds. So it's a very powerful tool for liquidity and immediate diversification for us.
We can go in the same order?
Yeah. Sure. Well, given that, you know, in our asset allocation approach, risk mitigation in times of stress is very important. We need liquidity, and when we make tactical bets, we need to be able to undo them very quickly. And so, similar to Kevin, when we have tactical positions, we prefer ETFs often, especially in areas where we can't use futures contracts. Using ETFs just allows us to move in and out very quickly and de-risk in a way that doesn't have a lot of price impact. and it allows us to do it quickly. And also, we use ETFs as strategic building blocks in many portfolios, especially in SMAs and others, where they're key. And in addition, to get access to narrow slices of the market as a multi-asset PM, I'm told I'm not supposed to be a stock picker. And so, prior to having a robust and diverse ETF market, if I wanted to buy a certain basket of stocks, I'd have to make a very strong case to the executive management team, to the board of trustees, for the mutual funds, and jump through a lot of hoops to be able to do so. And nowadays, I just go buy the ETF that corresponds to that, and it's done because I'm not stock picking anymore. So it simplifies my life dramatically.
Yeah, and there's not many places we don't use ETFs. So our portfolios are probably 95% ETFs, and that's a change from where we were 10 years ago when we probably had 50% ETFs. But as ETFs have evolved, gotten more granular, we've been able to solve all sorts of portfolio problems that we weren't able to solve before with ETFs. I like to say it's sort of the democratization of institutional management. So, we can provide a $5 million type solution to an investor for $100,000, right? I mean, can you imagine a global portfolio, currency hedge, access to, securities you typically wouldn't have access to, all for $100,000? It's pretty neat. So we do it for that. We do it for beta participation, like these guys talked about, asset class access. One of the unique things now with a lot of the smart beta ETFs is it gives me a clean way to implement time-tested strategies, whether it's low vol, whether it's factor, whether it's alternative weighting methodologies that are really tough to do with a 30 or 50 stock portfolio. So I can read the research in the Financial Analyst Journal, and I can go find an ETF that perfectly matches the strategy I want to implement and that's been tested over history. And you can't do that with individual stocks unless you have massive portfolios.
Okay, great. So my usage is quite similar to Doug, where we use ETF. Well, we start out with, we were mutual fund based in our retail asset allocation fund. So we're mostly using mutual funds until ETFs came along. We actually use some index funds. So for cheap beta and liquidity tool, at least for cheap beta, ETFs and index funds to us were pretty much equals. ETF provided additional liquidity abilities that index funds didn't, but we're a longer horizon investor where we weren't looking for so-called day trading. So it provided better liquidity, but not much further. But as Doug mentioned, or if you don't mind me sharing a little bit of storytelling of how we got involved in creating ideas for it. So here I am, an asset allocator on my fixed income side. We have quite strong credit capability in our active manager, and we're big believers of active management. However, we want to diversify our alpha generation. Credit's done great for the last 7 years here, and we thought we're pretty long credit alpha generation. We have some mortgage alpha generation, and we asked ourselves, in this part of the cycle, how do we diversify our alpha capabilities within our active management, within fixed income? As an example, and we did this in other asset classes as well. So a couple of years ago, we embarked on a research after we purchased IndexIQ, worked with them, and we came out with the whole CFA Institute's research, which is backdated and says fixed income may be mean reverting over a longer period, but over a shorter period, there is actually an alpha generation style-wise that momentum actually can pick up signals and generate alpha. So for anybody interested in looking at it, the ticker is AGGP, AGP, which allows us to buy beyond ag, high yield and emerging market debt to generate alpha. So what it did for our portfolio construction was to diversify our alpha capability away from credit mortgage to saying, hey, if I got a momentum-centric ETF that generates alpha, I can diversify my alpha strategy. So we've been embarking on such examples.
Thank you. Thank you. Our next question is... If you maybe Doug and Paul can help us with this one. It's what ETF asset classes do you use? Are there any asset classes where you prefer or where you would not prefer to use ETFs, and why?
Well, I'll start. So, give you four examples. So, maybe, and I'll reverse it, when do we use a stock versus an ETF? So one is if an industry has wide dispersion. If you think about industries or asset classes, if you look at returns and the average doesn't really describe what the experience is underneath the bell curve, that's an area we want to be stock picking. That's sort of a fertile field for stock picking. So, like, I don't bother reading research from oil field service analysts, from home building analysts, from utility analysts, because, you know, at the end of the day, if the average is 10%, the really good ones are 12, the really bad ones are at 8, and my choice should be, do I want to be in the industry or not, not which home builder do I pick, because dispersion of returns is fairly narrow. So I'm going to, you know, tend to use ETFs there and save my stock picking for groups where dispersion is wide, like retail. I also look at, you know, the likelihood of capturing those returns. So biotech's a good example. It might have really wide dispersion of returns, but at the end of the day, you get 20 strikeouts and 2 home runs, and no matter how good of a stock picker you think you are, you're probably not going to consistently find those 2 home runs. So we'll tend to use an ETF for that in stock pick and other industries where likelihood of capture is high. If you think about it, you know, is it right-tailed or left-tailed, right? Retail is a good example of one where you have very few in the left tail, right? If I just avoid, like, Sears and JCPenney's, most retailers have outperformed, right? And then, you know, kind of the third time I'll stock pick is if there just isn't an ETF out there that can actually capture those sort of the industry I'm looking at. So if I'm looking at credit cards, if I'm looking at payroll processing, if I'm looking at drug stores, you know, these certain niche places where, you know, I can't just buy the consumer staple ETF or the financial ETF because it's not going to get, you know, the loading I'm looking for. So there's some unique spots, but I've been finding ETFs are solving far more problems than I come across than having to use individual stocks.
If I may add, when I first started, I'm a bond guy. When you look at my career path, more than equity guy or asset allocator, started on a fixed income trading floor. So when I looked at ETFs when it first came out, I used to have limits on where I thought it could play, because despite ETF liquidity, you have the underlying asset class liquidity that will dictate. And people were trying to pour into ETFs, asset classes that were highly liquid. So I had a bit of a glass half empty view on success of some of those asset classes, but I've been getting a little more religion on how ETFs actually transforming liquidity of certain asset classes. And I'll take high yield as an example. And I'm not completely there, but I'm there a lot more today than I was 5 years ago. Taking an example of high-yield ETF, we were embarking on it. Actually, we did launch one, a little more higher liquidity, higher quality ETF, HYLV. I'll shamelessly mention that as well. What's happened in high-yield space with regard to ETF is, at one point, very cynical myself in 2008, because high-yield ETFs didn't quite capture the bid offer that was needed for the market. Since then, what's happened is more and more people are trading it, and it's those of us who trade ETF has actually created liquidity in ETF space, whereby traders, the market makers themselves, are actually hedging their book using a high-yield ETF, as opposed to CDX or as opposed to some other form of derivatives. So interestingly, ETFs more and more are kind of pushing boundaries of liquidity. So I'll leave it at that.
Thanks, Yaya. And what about you, Paul, in terms of where you prefer or maybe not prefer to use an ETFs?
Well, I mean, in general, given that we're trying to, you know, generate alpha through dynamic asset allocation across all global markets, you know, it's equities globally, fixed income globally, currencies and commodities, we tend to go to futures and forwards first in most of our portfolios, because those are just typically simple and easy and fairly straightforward, without any concerns about price impact and whatnot. And then from there, where there are asset classes that there is no corresponding future, that we then tend to use ETFs. So this tends to be, you know, high yield, like many here, emerging market debt, TIPS, investment grade debt on the fixed income side, and on the equity side, maybe more style specific equities, U.S. and globally, the factor ETFs that Doug mentioned earlier, for, minimum volatility, dividends, momentum, quality, value, and size, and then and commodity equity ETFs. In terms of where I don't like to use ETFs, in general, like I personally feel that like in bank loans, if I want bank loan exposure, I'd rather use an active manager because the idiosyncrasies of index construction with bank loans, like TXU was one of the biggest weight, because it was the most levered and largest deal out there, and then of course declared bankruptcy. So I prefer active management in bank loans. Also, personally, in like lower volatility, high yield, we have an internal active manager I think is excellent. Has a 20-year track record, does a great job. So I would use that any day over an ETF. And actually getting factor exposures, I would prefer actually to use a low tracking error equity manager that is going long, momentum, size, quality, and value. Because what we found in research along with that team is that there are these factor super stocks that have multiple exposures at the same time across those factors. And there are periods where those just don't work. And if you load up too heavily on those like factor super stocks, it can really undermine what you're trying to achieve in a diversified factor framework.
Thank you.
So if I may, given we're on a panel and it's all about debate, so I'm going to agree with Paul. However, give him a little debate. So like I said, we start with active management. We're a big believer in active management. So if you look at Mainstay's high yield fund, which we own a lot of in our asset allocation fund, it's a five-star Morningstar fund. Active management in high yield is absolutely spot on, right? That's the right place to be. However, we're also in the business of creating solution-based smart beta factors products in ETF. So I mentioned our HYLV, which you should go have a look. Because why we created this HYLV was actually not to fight our own great active manager. And in high yield and bank loan active management, absolutely I support is the right place to go as a core investment. But where you would use something like HYLV is actually it's a solution based in this like late cycle economy where you're wondering, should I give up some yield to reduce some risk in my credit exposure? But you know, recession is probably a couple of years out. You don't want to completely take your cash out of a higher yielding asset class. Where are you going to go, right? 1% cash? So you're going to want to take some risk off the table between now and when we go over the cliff here. And you need to give up some income and be a little less so-called greedy for taking risk off the table. And factor-based investing, solution-based ETFs allow you to be a little more thoughtful, quantitative. So we created an ETF that tries to do that. So that's where ETF can supplement a active manager and for you to start measuring your risk exposure and start reducing risk appropriately in an optimal way.
And I would just add that in my context, given that I have an active manager, it's called the Allianz GI Short Duration High Income Fund. It's beta 0.5 to the overall high yield index and volatility lower, meaningfully lower than the AG, than the Barclays US AG Index. So I tend to use, it's accomplishing the same thing. I tilt that way towards that portfolio when I want to de-risk in high yield and still maintain the income. So we're doing the same thing.
Yeah, we agree. So it's a boring debate. Sorry.
I love the comments.
There's also two active bank loan ETFs out there. So you have that option if you want to be active.
That's a great point, Doug. And I think that we think ETFs, we think passive, but nowadays we're getting more and more active ETFs out there as well. And also what the industry has coined as a smart beta, which is somewhere in between the active strategies and the passive methodologies. But with a lot of high-yield conversation, we have a high-yield expert here on Kevin, and he mentioned something very interesting to me in terms of how institutions can use ETFs in a different way or some other aspects to consider. What are these aspects that they should consider when they're using ETFs also, Kevin?
Yeah, so I think something that's often overlooked when you're long, when you own an ETF, you can lend this out. If you have a SEC lend program, there's a very attractive lend. This is an astonishing number, but up to about a week ago, the borrow on HYG, which is the largest high-yield ETF, was 300 basis points. And that's correct, 300 basis points. Now it's an opaque market, the sec lend market. That's, you're not always going to be able to lend it at 300 basis points. I think the average per annum is, you know, 60 to 80 bips, but that is income, right? So you can hold exposure to high yield. Again, one trade is diversified. At the same time, that's can essentially call it alpha on top of your returns. It's something a lot, you know, if you have a sec lend program, it kind of gets overlooked. A lot of, you know, people don't kind of bake that into the cake. Additionally, Jay was mentioning the derivatives market. I had mentioned before we can't do derivatives. I was referring to the CDS market because we don't have ISDAs and we can't do swaps or total return swaps, but we can do options. We can hedge our books. So the fact that we can't use the high-yield derivatives, it's a great tool for us where we can hedge our high-yield book. We can buy puts. And this market's growing. Jay was touching on that. It's more and more active every day. And then you can also sell covered calls. So you own the asset, and then you get extra income on top of that if you're defensive. And then also I'll just touch on a couple more things. An interesting point last week in high yield. High yield's been a little soft, the asset class lately. But last week there was actually an inflow into the HYG ETF. And this was actually due to that lend I mentioned, a 300 basis point lend. People were actually buying HYG to create borrow. So it's an interesting wrinkle in the market where the asset class is actually sort of going down, but you saw inflows where you saw outflows otherwhere. It's sort of a technical in the market where the inflows were creating shares to lend out. So it's interesting, and it's evolving all the time. And I'll mention one more thing real quick. Another use to gain exposure, another tool, you can create or redeem. In other words, the ETF dealers can take your portfolio in and give you shares of the ETF and vice versa. So if you're ever looking to quickly liquidate a portfolio or to quickly create a portfolio of cash bonds, that's another tool that can be used.
Thank you, Kevin. Those are great points. What Hilas was referring to, sometimes you will hear it as asset transfer, which is getting more and more common from ETF issuers working with investors. Great. So let's move to our next segment about implementation and how we select these ETFs, how do we execute these ETFs. So Doug, in your experience, you use mostly ETFs in your portfolios. You're probably looking at a lot of ETFs all the time. Have you had any experience looking at the differences between the title or the name of the ETFs versus looking under the hood? Have you found any surprises there?
Yeah, there's lots of surprises. You know, I think you can't judge a book by its cover, and I think that's what I would say about ETFs is just because something's called something doesn't mean it's going to perform that way. And you know, we like to think we're on a little bit of a treasure hunt every time we look at an ETF, and the treasure hunt is to find the bias. And there's a bias in everyone, and if you haven't found it, it's going to find you in a bad way at some point. Biases can be concentration, it could be capitalization, it could be sectors, it could be countries. You know, a couple of quick examples. You know, there's a biotech ETF that's got 75% of its holdings in the top 10. There's a biotech ETF that has 25% of its holdings in the top 10. Does that make a difference? Well, in the last 12 months, it made 30 percentage points difference, right? So I own biotech, but one is, you know, just the big guys, and one's a bunch, you know, more broadly dispersed. That's important. You know, I think about banks. You just had Chris Davis talk about banks in here. Probably nobody knows more about it than he does. But if you wanted to buy a bank ETF, don't buy the one that says bank ETF on it. Because if you're thinking about banks and you're thinking about the big folks, you know, the big diversified financials, you're not going to find many of them in the bank ETFs. The one that has the greatest exposure to the banks you're thinking about, you know, the big, you know, five banks is going to be the financial services ETF. You know, weird. It doesn't even have bank in the name. Another thing, you know, that we see is, if you're ever playing in any of the ETFs that have commodities in them, you know, oil, natural gas, or even the VIX, if they incorporate futures, they will do something very different than what you expect. And if you remember the old Series 7 or CFA stuff, we talked about contango and backwardation, you know, we see it all the time with retail investors. They buy the oil ETF because they think oil is going to go up. Oil goes up, and they still lose money, right? That's because you're buying, you know, you're not buying spot oil. You're buying one-year future oil, and if one-year future oil is deep in contango, you got to get above that hurdle rate. And, you know, we see that with natural gas and particularly the VIX. If you want to be a millionaire, go to Chicago and write VIX futures because the contango is 8 to 10% per month. So if somebody thinks the market's going to go down, it's got to go down a lot to really make money on that trade. So be careful of anything with the futures incorporated into it because it's not going to act the way most people expect.
Thank you, Doug. Paul, when you're selecting ETFs in your portfolio, what is the most important selection criteria for you?
Well, on the tactical positions, it all comes down to liquidity. You know, is it large enough such that we can get out pretty quickly when we need to de-risk the portfolio? That's the overriding characteristic. For more core, you know, strategic positions, it's a combination of, you know, liquidity fees and sort of the closeness with which it matches our underlying index for that particular asset class. So fairly straightforward stuff.
Right.
Can I mention liquidity real quick just because I know there's going to be a trading panel, but some of you may be of the size. I mean, generally ETFs trade in 50,000 share, or creations and redemptions are 50,000 share. So the extent that you get close to that, 20, 20, 30,000 share orders, you should be able to get pretty darn close to NAV. So what we found is there are oftentimes that we're buying an ETF where we're doing 2,000% of the daily volume. We can get it done, you know, at NAV or a penny on either side. So liquidity is something to be concerned of, I think, if you really want quick in and out. But if you have some patience and you're willing to work an order over the day, we haven't found that to be a stopping block for us as much.
Yeah. Do you mostly use brokers that execute on those trades? Because if using platforms, you get restricted.
Yeah, but most of the platforms will be working with those brokers too. So a lot of times if I'm going to you name the ETF, I'm going to go to iShares or State Street or whoever and say, this is what I'm trying to do. They're going to know my trading platform. I mean, if you're at one of, you know, the top 20 firms, they deal and they can direct them and say, hey, there's liquidity at this firm, and they'll help guide you through that.
So I can give you a live example. This is how we ended up speed dating with our Index IQ, and we ultimately bought because I was looking for an M&A, right, M&A merger ETF. It's actually called M&A. So there's an ETF liquidity and there's the underlying asset liquidity we talked about, as long as the underlying asset liquidity is liquid, if ETF is less liquid because it's thematic and less people trade a thematic ETF as opposed to broad ETF, you can call the index provider. So we actually called Index IQ and said, before we knew who they were, and said, hey, we're interested in your ETF. We know it's liquid, but it's not as well traded. Can you create shares? So, you know, we lined up how many exposure we want, you know, divided by what's the creation share, and they created 20 shares for us. And you got it at the underlying value. Now, on these TradeNet systems, as Doug mentioned, if you call them up, they will do that for you. Or you do have to take two steps to get there instead of just trade, but you can get there. So for me, smart beta ETFs are generally going to be less traded. So you're going to want, if you want thematic views as an asset allocator and you want to take that view, and as long as your underlying is liquid, it's possible and it's actually rewarding because you get to put your view the way you want to. But to be fair to also Doug's other comment earlier, do your research. When you get away from the bigger, broader ETFs and get into thematic ETFs, don't go with the name. You need a person in your group that actually will look at it, make sure it's what you want. Then it's rewarding to make the call and take two steps.
Did you say they created 20 shares?
So they're units?
Oh, 20
units, sorry. Sorry, I apologize. I'm using lingos.
Yeah, so in ETFs, like sometimes you will hear people talking about units or creation units.
Yeah.
Right? And just as a rule of thumb, I always, when clients ask me this question, I tell them, you know, if you're going to be trading anywhere from $1 million to $2 million an app, that's usually it's going to cover the creation unit for most of the ETFs out there, particularly the newer ones. And if you're going to be getting to sizes of creation unit multiples, then it's very easy that you're going to be working with an authorized participant broker
that can actually go and create with the fund, or some other broker that has access to an authorized participant to create. So it's going to be usually a what they call a high touch type of execution, as opposed to an electronic trading on the largest and most liquid ETF that you don't even have to care much about that part of the liquidity. But it's always possible. I think it's what we get from these experiences. Another concern that I hear a lot of the time when it comes to liquidity is with how these ETFs or how some ETFs have become so liquid. We have talked a lot about high yield, and high yield is an illiquid asset class. So does that raise any concerns? Kevin, you have been using this for a while. Do you share these concerns of people that look at these very high liquid ETFs in such an illiquid asset class?
Yeah, I don't necessarily share those concerns. We mentioned bank loans, maybe would have some concerns there, but with high yield bonds, I guess maybe the concern some people have is that if everyone sells the ETF, the underlying cash is going to be depressed, you know, and it's just going to be a complete washout, which is fair. But in my opinion, I'm not sure. I think the same thing can happen with redeeming mutual funds or broker dealers redeeming their own balance sheet. So I don't, in my opinion, I don't think it's any worse of a scenario for an ETF to sell off as anything else, in my opinion.
Right. Now, the last section of our panel, we have a lot of experience. These are people that take investment decisions and take they take the calls. So I want to ask them, maybe a couple of them can share with us, what are your current views and what are your favorite ETFs currently? Doug, maybe
yeah,
you can?
Yeah, sure, I'll start. So and I'm not ever allowed to mention specific ETFs, so sorry, I can't say specific names, but I'll give you some themes. So lately, the last 5 months, we've been taking money out of U.S. equity, putting it in international. Favorite spot there is kind of Euro monetary union type countries, which is important to make that differentiation, because if you just buy Europe, you're buying a lot of U.K., a lot of Switzerland. You know, we don't particularly like those countries. We like European monetary union type countries that are on the euro. So that would be, you know, one area. Just our little, you know, global asset allocation world. Across the board, we've generally taken somewhere between 10 and 15 points out of the U.S. and put it international just in the last 5 months. So, you know, that's a theme. International's cheap. They got the right catalyst. And you're seeing all the confirming signals that we're on the right track here. Interestingly, you know, the political environment where everybody thought maybe the U.S. has had it figured out after the election, there's a lot of, you know, rally based on all the things that maybe this administration would do. Saw the opposite in Europe, where everybody thought the world was going to end politically for Europe, and you've almost had a little bit of, you know, those, you know, rearrange themselves, where we've seen really great elections coming out of France, great elections coming out of, you know, Germany in the regionals. Even seen the Italian five-star movement push back. So, I mean, kind of across the board, there's been really positive things. If I look at the U.S., I'm with Chris Davis, which is I think the big banks are cheap. I think at the end of the day, banks follow. Price to book follows ROE. And ROE has been depressed because the numerator and denominator have been pushed down. I think that's all starting to change. I think, number one, you're going to see, you know, better income based on loan growth and based on all the expenses of legal, regulatory, et cetera, you know, coming down a little bit. And then, you know, if I look at the denominator, it's going to be all about the more that banks can return capital, and I guess we find that out tomorrow with the, what's today, Thursday? We find it out today, I guess, with the stress test. You know, you're going to be able to see them push ROEs up, and as a result, price to book goes up, and almost as long as I've been in the industry, it was like, if you can buy a bank at below 2x book, that's a steal. And I think if we can get ROEs back to where they were, that'll, you know, continue to be the case. And the big banks are the only ones that are still trading, you know, below 2x book.
Thanks,
Zach. Sure. Jay? So we're macro investors, so we got to look at everything top down and get to our results. So I look at the world, you know, we're in year 9 of this expansion, but, you know, economic expansions don't end on appointments, so you got to look at the underlying fundamentals. And we are seeing signs that we are probably in a late cycle, so what, you know, where do we go? Valuations are fairly expensive. In equities, I fully agree with Doug, actually. In equities, if you look at valuations, U.S. is clearly very expensive. However, earnings are actually what's causing, you know, this year's rally. And if you look at earnings, Europe's growing at about double the pace in corporate earnings than the U.S., and they're starting from a very depressed level, so they have a higher opportunity to rally further. So I agree also on U.K. that their earnings don't look positive with the Brexit, hard or soft. However, I'm comforted by one thing, that their earnings are very depressed. So they may not go up, because I don't see a catalyst for the earnings to improve, but I don't see how much more destruction they'll see. So I'm comforted by that, so I'm actually buying Europe. Mm-hmm. Now, you have to look at and consider currency. So we actually, again, everything we do, if it doesn't exist, we actually try to create it with our partners here at Index IQ. So we have a 50% hedged ETF. You know, everybody talks about the dollar's going to get stronger, but I think dollar's got to a pretty saturated point. So we decided, hedged, unhedged, let's go at 50% hedged, and we actually created that. So we're actually starting to shift money out of the U.S. into overseas. In fixed income, as I mentioned, again, we like active management. However, we think in this last maybe, I personally, if I have to put a number, I think the recession will happen in this decade. So I'm looking at maybe from next year, I'm going to start looking for it. You know, we got 1 to 3 years, depending on how bullish and bearish you're about the expansion energy left in this economy. So in fixed income, we're very aggressive in our allocation. We have been in high yield and bank loan, for that matter. We're starting to look for a measured way of reducing income. So a lot of people like to lean into yield and chase it when yields get compressed, spreads get compressed, and yields go down. Sorry, got to be very technically correct here. And what we're saying is, hey, in this late cycle, don't get greedy and chase it. Actually, lean away from it. Give up some yield, because you got to start being very careful on how you give it up. So we came out with a factor-based high-yield ETF that optimizes how much yield you give up. And using MCR, which is marginal contribution to risk, looking at spread and duration as a risk measure, to figure out a way that market can systematically look for volatility and shy away. So it worked wonderfully in energy crisis, right? The energy crisis of 2015 that hit high yield market didn't happen overnight, right? So this ETF, HYLV, won't hedge against the Twitter impact of our president tweeting something and taking the market down, because that just happens. However, the energy crisis did give you plenty of tremor and warning that the rating agencies perhaps cannot do, because that's just not the way they work. So if you think the market can give you some warning for bigger tremor volatility, then you want a systematic way of reducing and keeping most of your income, but giving some of it up for the downside risk. Thank you. Okay.
And Kevin, as a high yield expert, what's your current view for high yield in the current rates environment?
Yeah. We're very underweight high yield at the moment. We're about 500 basis points underweight. We do not like the asset class. There's a lot of risk. The structure of high yield, they're callable bonds. So what that means, they trade. They're trading to their call because they're so compressed. Jay mentioned the compressed yields. So what that means is your upside's really capped, and your downside is sort of, you know, unlimited. So we would stay away. We're very underweight. In terms of ETFs, if you were going, you mentioned low vol ETFs, that would be a better option. I would use caution as well with sort of a higher quality, you know, like a double B ETF, because those have duration. A lot of times investors feel that they're safer because they're in the higher quality section of the high yield market, but these, if rates back up, these will sell off. You'll get hurt the most there. So I would use caution there and just try and pick your spots with lower duration.
Thank you, Kevin. We are running a little bit out of time, but I wanted to leave at least time for how many questions, Nicholas?
One or two, because we have to keep the schedule.
Okay. So I have time for one or two questions.
Concerned that it's going to be
scenario could make ETFs be the leader in depressing the market, creating a problem that us regular people don't envision?
Yeah, I personally don't see that as a problem. I mean, if you think about what an ETF is, it's simply a it's no different than a mutual fund. One of Warren Buffett's favorite books is Adventures of Investing or something like that. And they have, you know, they have lots of different articles, but one's from the 50s, and it's all about the same fears when mutual funds came out, that there are all these dumb investors buying broad baskets that don't know what they own. And at the end of the day, we know mutual funds, you know what happened to them the next 50 years. It's been great. You know, there have been so many products that have gone through the gauntlet of the last 15 years and have not come out the other side. You know, auction rate preferreds, you know, CLOs, you know, all that, CDOs, all that kind of stuff. ETFs have come out stronger. And I think if there's a problem with the wrapper, Wall Street figures it out. And that's why lots of wrap things, closed-end funds, whatever, trade at steep discounts to their NAV. You haven't found that in ETFs. And that's because at the end of the day, shoot, if the market goes down, I can just redeem the ETF, get all the individual stocks. There's no real reason why it should trade at a large disconnect to the underlying NAV. So I don't see that as an issue. I think ETFs will get bigger. I think they'll basically you know, take a lot of the active strategies out there and kind of, you know, the tide is going to recede and we'll see who was a good manager just because they were fishing in a lucrative pond, right? And if that's the case, you don't need to pay 100 basis points for that.
Yeah, so I will echo that and say ETF did survive 2008 crisis. So people create the panic, and I don't know how us collectively, people, will create the next panic in the next recession. However, ETF has survived 2008, and I'm sure ETFs, some ETFs will selectively get hit, right, but broadly, I'm sure you'll be fine.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We've had some good discussion here about the fixed income ETF products, but I think in the bigger picture here, we're seeing an increasing adoption among institutional investors moving into fixed income ETFs. We're seeing a general migration of assets away from the cash markets toward the fixed income ETFs. Are we beginning to see the cracks of the OTC market model? And are these migrative flows likely to make the liquidity issues in the cash markets worse?
Kevin, would you like to?
Sure. We haven't adopted a full ETF platform as of yet, but, I mean, it's evolving. We've talked about a few ways that the market keeps evolving. As far as removing the OTC market, I think there's a place for both. I mean, with active managers, they're always going to be able to pick your spots, and by design, your ETFs are sort of going to be whole market, diversified, broad. So I don't know if it'll compl- but it's definitely going to cut into the space, if that answers your question.
Well, I would like to thank our panelists for the comments and for the debate. And well, that will put a conclusion to this panel and continue with the conference.